feet high. And well, it was an absolutely marvelous place, but not exactly Grand Central Station. I mean, I don't know who else stayed there ever, because it looked like they opened up the place for us. But we got there, and Mrs. Houston could hardly utter these words, but she said, "Bobby will see you at 7 o'clock in the morning." The next morning. Well, that really was an unexpected. And Mr. Byron said, shall I stay over? And I said, yes, please stay over and, you know, make yourself comfortable, this, that, and the other. And we got up the next morning very early, and Saroche came to pick us up in the car. And he drove us to the center. And that's when I became aware of the fact that we were in an uncharted corner of America, that, you know, we drove out on that highway, and there was nothing, you know, just swamp on one side and brush on the other and this and that and the other. But I do distinctly remember that I'm not given to any psychic phenomena or anything, darn it, but I remember distinctly that when we went inside the gates of the center. Now, it's true, I wasn't exactly calm, cool, and collected. I was skeptical and thought that this whole thing has gone too far anyway, and I'm going to get caught in a terrible trap, that I adore Miss Krask, and I have been faking this whole thing, and now everybody's going to know that I was faking, because, I mean, who's he? And, but we passed the gates of the center, and in that condition, even, I remember being so terribly impressed when I heard silence for the first time in my life, if that at all sounds sensible. It was the most amazing experience. It was a wonderful experience. The silence was the presence. And it was like the motor of the car, didn't make any noise. And it was so ravishingly beautiful. And this silence where nothing else was needed. And by the way, it was a beautiful morning. Okay. So we drove up to the center, and in those days it was considerably smaller. The original kitchen was where we went, and it was the original kitchen, that one little tiny little building there, and there was a brick patio behind it. That brick patio is now that transition place between the original kitchen and the ping pong tables and everything like that. And I went nose to nose with Ronald's chest. And you know, Ronald's face is rather sharp. And she looked down at me and she said, "You could have sent a telegram." And she was not at all pleased. And I thought to myself, but we did send a telegram. And she sort of walked away, and I wondered, what's wrong with her? You know, and who is she anyway? Never mind. And then there we got Kitty, and Kitty was all and I fell in love with Kitty immediately. Because she didn't, you know, she wasn't. And then she started talking about Baba in the most extraordinary way. In ways that she said, "It doesn't really matter how you take Baba as long as you accept him." When you think this, I didn't even know what she was talking about. And I'd never seen the lady before in my life. And, you know, she was like a bottle of bubbly water that she didn't have a bottle big enough to hold. And she but I did fall in love with her. And we sat down on a bench. She said, "Sit down, make yourself comfortable." Make yourself comfortable, sure. But we sat down on a bench, like a sort of gingerbread. And this bench was on the patio, and it was facing, I did not know it at the time, but it was facing the lagoon cabin. All right? And it was Sura, Zebra, Skipper, and me on the end. And we were all squashed there, you know, like third graders. And Delia came out. And Delia, I'm sure some kind of conversation took place, but I'm sure I don't know what it was. But anyway, she took Zebra. And I hadn't really thought very much about the well, she's taking her to see Baba. But suddenly it became a reality. And I watched them go down the path and turn the path to the lagoon cabin and go up the steps, and nothing. And all of a sudden, Zimbra exploded out the side door. I mean, she was absolutely bawling tears. I mean, that's not too unusual with Zimbra. But that particular way was. And I watched, you know, and I thought, what is that? And then Sura went. Now, Zimbra was dark and small. And she was not as beautiful as Mera, but she looked a lot like her. She had a rather heart-shaped face, and she had almond eyes and dark brows and a widow's peak, and really a very beautiful girl. Now, Sura was very tall and blonde, with bold features, but very beautiful features. And mind you, none of them were babes in the woods. But anyway, then it was Sura's turn to stroll over. And I was sort of getting interested by this time. And she went in, and a terribly similar thing happened, except she came out the same door and went off into the woods in another direction, you know, buckets of tears, using, I think, her blouse to contain them or something like that. Now, Skipper was the one I knew the best and the longest and had the greatest facade of sophistication. I don't think she was, but it worked for most people. And I thought, now this, well, you know, and my back was getting stiffer every minute. And I watched this whole bit, and Skipper came out and walked straight into a tree. And just stood there. And she was blubbering and crying right in front of this tree. And I mean, right then and there, I would have called the whole thing off. I don't, but, you know, and I was sitting there, and Dina came and smiled. I just sat there. And then she took me by the wrist, you know. And I, you know, I don't know what went through my mind, but reluctantly I did stumble down that path. And Delia, by the way, was not in great shape either. She was bawling. And I thought that was distinctly odd. And we got to where the path curved up to the lagoon cabin. And I, you know, screen doors in sunlight, strange things happen, like scrim. And I saw something white, you know, flicker behind the screen door. And I dropped my eyes like that. I knew that was Baba. And I dropped my eyes and I walked up. I mean, I didn't just look at the, I mean, it was double. And I walked all the way into the cabin that way. And I didn't even see Baba's feet. I knew he was there. And finally, I lifted my eyes and I looked into Baba's face. And I looked into Baba's eyes. And it is quite impossible to describe. But it was like his eyes, at that, I don't know what color his eyes really were. To me, they were the warmest, softest brown I've ever seen in my life. And they were endless. There was nothing behind his eyes. His eyes just went on forever. And you looked and looked and looked and looked. And I didn't do anything. And a strange thing happened again. It was not psychic or metaphysical or anything like that. But it was like I was standing in a mummy case. And I've forgotten which direction, but this mummy case cracked. And it started here. It may have started back. Came up, and I could hear it. I mean, I couldn't hear it cracking, but I heard it cracking up over the, and then it fell off on either side. And Bob opened his arms, and I literally stepped out of it, and he embraced me. And that's an impossible thing to describe. It's certainly going to be the greatest moment of this life, of mine. I had never known what love was. I'd never been denied love by anybody. But love is an inadequate word for what Baba gave. And I've never actually felt anything like it before or since. I felt parts of it afterwards, but Baba was so gracious and so generous at that time that something, and it was 25 years before I recalled this, but at that moment when Baba embraced me, I knew without doubt that I would have gone to the stake. I knew that whatever happened to me, the world, or anybody else, was exactly the way it ought to be. If that makes sense to you. And I did not remember that for 25 years. And for some reason, it came into my head. I had a total recall that when whatever happens is exactly the way it ought to be. It's exactly what he wants. And, I mean, that's not a constant state of knowledge. But at that moment, it was there. And I was so overwhelmed, if that's the word. There is no word. But I do remember that the generosity of what Baba gave me. I did not cry. Boy, did I want to. And I could not. I don't know. But the first thing was Baba smiled, and what he said was, "I am happy." After what he had given me, then he said that he was happy. And yeah, I understand that philosophically a little bit. But he did that several times, that he presented you with the biggest gift in your entire life. And then he would say how pleased he was. All right. Then Baba sat me down on the south end of the lagoon cabin, on the bench. And that's the only time I ever saw Baba before he had severe physical injury. And he was in white, and his hair was loose. And he strode up and down the other side of the cabin. And he was so ravishingly beautiful that there's nothing to compare it with. There's no way to describe it. It's unique. And his walk, you've never seen a freedom like that, never. And, I mean, a grace and a spring and a rhythm and a joy and a power. Anything you want to say, it was all in that walk. And he was very slender then. And his hands were exquisite, and he had them behind his back, and he was doing that thing that he does with his fingers. They're moving all the time. It's not at all like a nervous tic or nervousness, but they were moving all the time. It was a stimulus, an activity. I mean, immense energy, devoid of any kind of nervous quality. And then he stopped, and he looked out the window, and that's, I remember. Away from me, it's like I wasn't there. And yet that's when I saw his hand folded behind his back and these beautiful fingers dancing like that. And then he came over and he sat down in front of me. I believe I was sitting this way and he sat that way, facing that way. And Rano and Delia were there. And one or the other was reading the alphabet board, because he had the alphabet board in those days. And I don't remember everything he said. The first thing he said, "I love you." And then he said, "I love you more than you will or can ever know." I don't know which one it was, but "I love you more than you will ever know or you can ever know." And then he said something else, and I don't remember any of the rest. And then he told Rano, and I don't have any idea how long this took. No idea at all. Judging from the... I don't even have any idea how long it took with the girls, so I couldn't judge by that. But anyway, he sent for the girls, and they came back looking an absolute mess. I had time to remark on that. And he sat us down in the same order as it happened. And this is something I don't remember, but Rano does. And she told me when I was back in India in 79, but she said that Baba stood up in front of us and that he stopped in front of Zebra for several moments and he looked out the window. And then he moved in front of Asura and he stopped there and so on down in front of each one of us. I don't have any memory of that, but Rana said he did. And she found it curious. That's why she remembered it. And then Baba sat down, and then he said, I was with you in the plane yesterday. And he said, now you must take me back with you. Well, that didn't really make much sense to me. You know, I mean, first of all, I was an idiot, and still am, but I was more so. And, but okay. I mean, I got the gist of what that was about to be alive. To be alive. And then he sent us off. And to cut a long short, you know, much longer story short, the way back was just like the way coming. I mean, I thought, for sure, no way. And guess what? We really and truly were legally grounded in Louisville. And by this time, this was the second day, and we were all principals or soloists in AIDA. And AIDA was that evening's performance. That meant four principals were out. And sure, we had understudies, but so forth and so on. Anyway, and we missed a bye. We got to the, and I said, well, we'll go rent a car. I thought, you know, everything was over. And he said, are you a good driver? And I said, well, I'm all right. And he said, well, you know, I'm as good a driver as I am a pilot. And he said, you have me hired back to Bloomington. Do you want me to drive? And I said, sure. He thought it was an airplane. Must have gone 90 miles an hour. But I was not afraid. I mean, this man could do anything, obviously. And the triumphal scene in AIDA is the final curtain of the second act. And it's a big schmiggity. You've all seen it and all heard it. Well, it's without it, you know, AIDA doesn't exist. All I can tell you is that we drove up, finally, to the auditorium. I believe it wasn't a theater, it was an auditorium. And we heard the applause for the final curtain of the second act. When, you know, just as the curtain was coming down, we got there. And the company was hysterical because they had not heard from us and they had heard nothing but news reports of how ghastly the weather was and how dangerous it was, and there were private advisories that if you have a plane, don't go near it. And a couple of planes were hit by lightning and, you know, smashed into pieces, and the company was absolutely hysterical. And you're not going to believe this. I mean, I didn't believe it at the time. No, I mean, but anyway. So we go downstairs to reassure our friends, right? And to whom do we bump? But Mr. Bing. Now, I did not know it at the time. The performance was a shambles. The understudies didn't know, or they had to step in another place. And then, of course, the people who moved out of their places into the understudy, people had to step in for them. And there were so many of us out, and I partnered the ballerina. My understudy, the final overhead lift. That's the final curtain. He dropped her. Well, she wasn't injured. But never mind, he dropped her flat. And we went into Mr. Bing, and I said, well, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Bing, but you know the weather was so bad. And he was absolutely furious. And he said, well, you knew this might happen. And I, boy, Mr. Tagful, right? I said, yes, sir, but you let us go. Well, I wasn't in a mood for standing there taking abuse. But it was a mistake. Well, he pulled himself up, and he was always dressed in a wing collar and tails, always. And stalked off. Well, the only addenda that I have to that is that the company didn't know how to treat us. They would walk on the other side of the street. And here we are in places, you know, huge metropoli like Bloomington. We're not conspicuous or anything. And you get to the corner and you see four friends walk to the other side of the street, you know, to avoid you. They didn't know what, they weren't rude, they just didn't know how to treat us. And I think it was a couple of days later, and I've forgotten where we were, but we were doing Don Giovanni. And in those days, if you were a dancer, no matter how important you were as a dancer, you also did supering, and which is, you know, extra work. So, and I remember, I was figurante. They made it sound better. I wasn't a supernumerary, I was a figurante. In that, I had to carry, in Don Giovanni, I had to carry on Doña Elvira's period luggage. I was her footman, right? Special costume, special wig, and these period luggage. And, you know, literally, I walked across the stage behind Regina Resnick or whoever was singing the role and went into the hotel, you know, the inn, and that was it. But I got down there early because I was a little disoriented. And I had the things in my hand, and there wasn't, you know, this is something like the 18th scene, no, the 16th, 13th scene of Don Giovanni, of which there are 22, and the dancers aren't in it, and the chorus are not in it except to the very end, and so forth and so on. So there was nobody on that stage. And I was upstage, you know, right where I ought to be, and just standing there, and I knew somebody was behind me. And I turned around, and it was Mr. Bing. And he looked me straight in the eye, but some minute, I didn't know, I said, good evening, and he didn't even answer. He just sort of looked at me. And he said, tell me, did you find what you were looking for? And I said, a great deal more, Mr. Bing. He clamped his jaw shut. And it was like smoke came out of his ears. He turned on his heels and never spoke to me again. He was, I don't know what made him mad. He didn't say a word. He turned and walked away. And Mr. Bing, what the hell was he doing there? And he was by himself. And there wasn't another human being from the whole company there. I mean, even Doña Elvira wasn't there. And Mr. Bing is walking around in the wings, asking funny questions. Well, anyway, so that is the story. That is the story of when I first met Baba.
Isn't there something about what Baba was doing while you folks were...
Oh, yes. Well, that's a story that I learned 20 years later of why Rano was so strange and why Mrs. Houston was so hysterical. It seems that day that we were flying, Baba made everybody's life absolutely, miserable. He himself was very, very agitated and very, very irritable, and that nobody could do anything right. And his constant talk and concern was about us in the airplane. And he would call everybody who was there in at several different times during the day. And he said, what do you think has happened? And of course, nobody knew what had happened. And I know even Elizabeth told me that she was an aviatrix, you know. So he called her in for a professional opinion. And he said, do you think they've gone down? And she said, well, I have no idea about it. And he said, well, do you think it's possible that they've gone down? And she said, he pestered her so. You know, she said, well, I don't know. And he said, no, I ask you, do you think it's possible? And she said, well, yes, of course, in the weather like that. Apparently the weather reports were just dire, that you never get weather reports like that anymore. I don't know. And then he called the men. Now, Rano has never told me why she was so peckish about it. But, excuse me. He called her in, he called everybody in. And at one point, he had Mrs. Houston, I believe it was Miss or someone, make sandwiches. And they were to go to the airport and wait for us. in case we were hungry when we got there. And he sent the men 12 miles into town. They had gotten the telegram by telephone, and Baba had sent them in to pick up the telegram paper, even. And then he sent them out 12, you know, and passed, you know, to find out where we were, was there any news for about us. Anyway, the whole center was completely disrupted. And he made everyone uncomfortable, as though they were responsible for it. And the truth is, we were responsible for it. And that's why Rano said, you could have sent a telegram, you know, and let us know where you were. But then the nicest story of all was that Kitty and Mrs. Deuce, of all people, told me this story. She was there when Baba was going to retire. And he had that telegram in his pocket of his tunic or his coat. And we had just called. It was just 8, you know, after 8. And she was with Baba. And when the news came, he was in the garden of the, what's that called? Guest house. And when the news, and she said that Baba all of a sudden absolutely relaxed and just beamed, you know, he shone, which he did. I've seen him that a few times. It's like, I don't mean you could read by the light, but it was like light emanated from him. It was so, I don't know, something so marvelous. And then he turned to Mrs. Deuce and he said, you know, I wasn't going to work tomorrow, but I'm a slave to love. And he patted the telegram that we had sent him. Mm-hmm. And that's when he had consented to see us the next day. And I think that's all of that. That's what you were talking about. Are there any questions that you think are not philosophical ones, but that you'd like to ask about? Several of us talked at Baba House in New York, and the theme was supposed to be what it was like being with Baba. You know, what's your life in 25 words or less? But if there are any things you would like to know, please ask them. I always feel that people are very reluctant to.
How old were you then?
I heard about him when I was 19. I met him when I was 25.
And how old were the women?
A bit younger than I, but close. Maybe 24 and 23.
When you were with Baba, do you remember if you said anything to him?
My memory is I never had anything to say to Baba. Except yes and no when asked. I do have a story about that Baba had the way of, that, you know, I was with him in 52, briefly in 52, but then I was in with him for some time in 56 and 58 and in India in 62. And the times that we were places where we would be, all of a sudden, Baba had this way of all of a sudden, just out of the blue, and, you know, he was making a dissertation or answering some, you know, profound question, and he would look at me and smile and he'd say, Tex, are you happy? And my answer always was that of a blubbering idiot. Oh, yeah. And it was true. It was absolutely true. And every time he did that, I said, yeah, sure, I'm happy now, but what about the rest of the time? You know, my life's pretty rotten. Come on already. And I was going to say to him, yeah, I'm always happy when I'm with you, Baba, but, and I'm here to tell you, it never happened. Every time he pulled that out of the blue, he would look at me with those eyes and say, are you happy? And I said, yes, Baba. And I never, you know. And then, and I don't even remember this, but it had to happen. In 1962, I do remember part of it, when we were in India. And the last day that we were there, he called the dancers and Miss Kress in alone. And that's the day that he said, very casually and offhand, you will never see me. This is the last time you will see me in this body. Which turned out to be quite true. But he said something, and he turned to me. I don't think it was after that. I'm not saying it in sequence. But he turned to me, and he said, Tex, are you happy? And of course my usual, you know, intelligent answer. But what I didn't even hear, and everybody else here, he chuckled and he said, "Here, but not there." And I didn't even hear it.
You said here and not there?
He said, "Yes, here, but not there." Which was the whole story. And I didn't even hear it, but everybody else heard it. I mean, they told me about it, they brought it up, and I didn't know what they were talking about. But anyway, so that was, that funny thing about it, lots of funny things about it.
So there were four different occasions you were with Bob, and the last was in 62?
Yes.
That was in India?
Yes.
What was going on?
Well, that was the, what did he call it? The East-West Gathering. That's what it's called. And my personal experience there was that always before, my relationship and when Baba was in America, when I was with him, it was all intensely personal. And that's the marvelous thing about it, by the way. Do you know? And I feel that I was very, very lucky, because when I first met Baba, I'm the only one of the dancers that I know that it happened precisely in this way. I don't really know what happened to them, but it didn't happen in quite this way. I went sailing off into the stratosphere, and I came back to a job after first meeting Baba, and boy, there wasn't anything on this world that I wanted. You know, the great skeptic that really had been pulling everybody's leg and everything like that. There was nothing, I didn't want it, and I was a very ambitious young man, don't get me wrong. And vicious along with, you know, not all averse to stepping on a few toes along. No, nothing serious, just an elbow. And, but I wasn't interested in anything. I only wanted one thing, and it was to be back with him. Not even in his presence. And really, this is true. I wouldn't, if I was just outside the building, if I were just around, that's all, it was an awful state. It was euphoric. Yes, because I was really sailing. But at the same time, it was an awful state because I wasn't there. And it was this carryover. And you see, something strange happened because then I had no idea when I would ever see him again. And we were forbidden to go to we were forbidden to do anything, you know. So there was, then he had the accident in Prague. And then, I believe it was 2 months to the day, July, and he came back to New York after recuperating at Ivy Deuces and gave us permission to see him again, you know? And by that time, I had made the one coat. I don't know why, but anyway, I did. Oh, I know why. It was to keep my sanity. Unless I could think about Baba all the time, I was just an hysterical, nervous wreck. I mean, yeah, I was in rehearsal and I could beat myself to death, you know, kick up my legs and work up a sweat and everything like that. But the minute that I sat down, I'm, you know, and so I made him a coat, okay, which led to a lot more trouble. But anyway, so I was all primed and ready, boy, for another shot of this stuff. And I walked in, it was 104 degrees that day in New York, which is not the most pleasant place. And Mrs. Deuce's apartment on 66th Street was not air-conditioned, as most places were not. And I remembered Bob quite accurately as the most beautiful creature on earth, which he was. When I first saw him, his hair was, I don't know, it was like spun by angels. And you know, it always looks a little disarrayed. And it was that way. But there was something about that that was just magical. And his skin was the most beautiful color. I remember it as honey colored. Maybe dark honey, kind of amber. And there was like a light underneath the skin. And the vitality, the beauty of the coloring of that skin. And his walk and everything like that. Well, all of that, you know, was pretty close. And I walked in and I see a man lying on a bed with his leg in a cast, obviously suffering from the heat, his arm in a sling, and his hair bedraggled by perspiration, and obviously very, very ungray. And Baba paid no attention to me. He said, "Sit down." And I sat down. And Baba took my hand And he, I guess it was his left hand, I don't know which hand. I've forgotten which arm was injured. Anyway, he took his good hand, and he looked out the window, and he pressed my hand into his chest. I mean, he pressed, and Baba had strength that was amazing. I mean, I knew my hand wasn't going to break or anything like that, but none of you gentlemen can press that hard, I assure you. And for some time, and then again, I think without looking at me, he took a grape, put it in my mouth, and the minute I bit on it, he said, go. You talk about a letdown. You don't know what that's like. I went to the fourth basement, from the clouds to the fourth basement. But in retrospect, I do understand one thing. It wasn't really comfortable up there. But at the same time, there was that juice, you know, of that euphoria. You would have stayed there. You're not going to stay in the fifth basement by your toenails. You're going to climb out. Because I tried that. I was so disappointed. I was moaning and groaning. It was miserable. So I believe that emotionally, you know, some surface in that, I gained some kind of balance. I mean, I wasn't going to stay in the pits like that. That's ridiculous. I was willing to stay up there, but I wasn't willing to stay down there. So he knocked me down there. And I crawled out, you know, and groaned inside. And okay, if that's the way it's going to be, I'm not going to see him and this and that. And yeah, okay. Now, I don't know. This is my own brilliant reasoning. And you've got to take that with about four salt licks. But I do know one person who wouldn't let go. For instance, when she saw Baba, she wept and wept, and I told you I couldn't, I never did. But she wept and wept, and it's wonderful. And you could tell that it was wonderful, because she wasn't weeping out, so it was a fantastic release. And I never got that. But she wouldn't let that go. And every time she saw Baba, that's exactly the way it was. She was like, you know, a sponge. If you had squeezed her, she would have run water. But every time I saw Baba, he was different. And I saw him differently. And please, that sounds pretentious. I don't mean it that way. I must preface that with that every time I saw Baba, I never wanted to go. Never, never. And when I say I didn't want to go, I mean, it wasn't that I just didn't want to go. I actively know I don't want to go. So that I went through hell every time he came. And I always knew that I would go. And when I finally did, I always saw him in a different way. And I cannot explain exactly how that was, in how he was different. But he was. But it was always intensely personal, except India. And then it was totally impersonal. We were there for some sort of purpose, what I do not know. And I saw Baba in a way I'd never even thought about him. And I don't say I saw it fully or anything like that, but I saw him in power. Magnificent power, immense, gigantic power. Not threatening and not ominous, just that way. And I remember that day that we were in the Pandal. I think it was the first day, I'm not sure. And it was November. It never rains in India in November, I'm told. Never. Under any conditions. The sky turned black. And I mean buckets poured. And that was that day. Have you heard that story of how the crowd panicked and rushed Baba? Because he was embracing people. And when this all happened, well, the excitement in the air was really something extraordinary. You can hardly imagine that. I mean, I don't know how many thousands there were of us, but really without warning, this dramatic, you know, it turned dark and it started pouring. And for some reason or other, the people thought they were not going to get to Baba. And there was a mad rush. Well, I will never, never forget that mandali were like quicksilver. I mean, I don't know where they came from, even. They weren't even on the platform. They had surrounded Baba with their arms, and I mean the atomic bomb, a patent tank wouldn't have gotten through those arms. But along with that, an awful lot of people, not Slowhead here, but never mind, an awful lot of people did jump up and form a chain to stop. These were the Indian people. See, the Westerners were seated in front. And he did favor us, as far as I know. We saw more of him. And the Indian people were in the back. And, but not all of us in the front were Indian. I mean, we're Western. There were a lot of Indians, but obviously, I know a special one, something like that. And people did and they formed a human chain to stop them rushing the stage. And in this turmoil, and I mean turmoil, really and truly, and it all happened so very, very quickly. And I, for some reason, I was sitting in the middle that day, literally in the middle section. And, you know, in 2 seconds you were knee-deep in mud. Literally 2 seconds. I mean, I moved my feet, you know, and these people were rushing about, and there was this terrific energy and anxiety and immense vitality in the air. And there was one magic moment that the crowd parted like that, and I saw Baba, and he was weaving back and forth, and this look of... I don't know how to describe it. It was kind of a joy, it couldn't be mad, it was Baba. But this unrestrained, and it weaving, like moving like that. And I said, oh, so that's what it's all about. And that was that. And I always had the feeling, and that's only that, that whatever happened that day, that's why we all got there. That's why we all went to India. That moment... That I do believe the Meghtan, you know, wouldn't compare to the energy that was in that tent. And from all over the world, the Mahatma collected all these people. And whatever it was that he wanted to accomplish, I felt, you know, that was, because from there on it was down, you know, dramatically speaking, anyway. And he was very kind. He let us stay. But I thought the whole thing's over, whatever it was that he wanted to do. But that time, see, he was taught completely impersonal. But it was wonderful, just the same, to see him like that.
So did the pilot stay home at the hotel there in Myrtle Beach?
Huh?
Did the pilot stay home at the hotel in Myrtle Beach?
Well, he stayed there overnight, but then he flew us back to, you know, until we got, and then he drove us to Blue. Oh! And when we got to Bloomington, eventually, and you know, the disaster struck and everything like that, we took him out for a steak. And I don't know why we felt compelled to tell him why we went, but somehow we felt obliged. And I think it was a mistake, because we sent him as a gift, we sent it through his company, a very, very expensive wallet. And he never even acknowledged receipt of it. So I think somehow or other we did the wrong thing.
Told him about at the steak dinner.
Well, we told him why we went down there as best we could. I mean, we didn't go into depth. And he made not one comment. Not old? Or, nothing. But he was that kind of guy. You know, there was no excessive chatter ever.
You did a good pilot for the right stuff.
What's that?
You did a good pilot for the right stuff.
Yeah.
And what about your friends, Zebra and Skipper?
Oh, well.
What's happened to
them? Oh dear. Strange things. Lost contact completely with Sura. I think Sura was the first one. And I think she saw Baba in 56. But I'm not sure of that. But by the end of the 50s, Sura had disappeared. She led a hellish life at one point. I know I saw her. And that was the last time I saw her. And things were not good. And I do know where she is. I know she's alive. I know that she's very successfully and advantageously married and so forth and so on. And one day I know they're going to hear from her again. But then nothing, all those years. And then Zebra, we were close for a long, long time. And I think, no, it was before Baba dropped the body the last time I saw her. And she, by that time I had known her a very, very, very long time. And for whatever reason, she turned on me and fired a salvo of 20 years of resentment towards me and towards some others. And she sort of disappeared. She went through a very difficult time, and some of us sort of made sure that she ate. Because in theater, it's very possible that you don't. And she resented that very, very much. And so...